Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop. For this Monday, September 8th, I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Daughters of Sarah, Albany, New York, providing a continuum of care for seniors, offering them opportunities to live at age gracefully with dignity and respect. DaughtersofSarah.org. September is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Today, we welcome Dr. David Kosminski from Capital Region Urology, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners Medical Associates. We'll talk about the importance of prostate cancer screening and detection and early management. Dr. Kosminski specializes in minimally invasive and robotic surgical procedures for the management of a wide range of urological and men's health issues. The number to call here is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. September is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, and today we welcome Dr. David Kosminski, a general urologist with Capital Region Urology, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners. Dr. Kosminski specializes in minimally invasive and robotic surgical procedures for the management of a wide range of urological issues, including genitourinary cancers, men's health issues, and complex urinary disorders. Dr. Kosminski earned his medical degree from the University of Michigan Medical School. If you have a question, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or call 800-348-2551. Dr. David Kosminski, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Ray, for having me.
All right, it's Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. We'll start with the basics. Why is it important that we be aware of this?
Super important. Prostate cancer is an extremely common form of cancer for men. 1 in 8 men in the United States will be diagnosed with prostate cancer at some point in their life. It's an extremely common cancer in American men, but it's the 5th leading cause of mortality worldwide for men in cancer. It is a highly curable cancer when screened appropriately, and screening is relatively easy. So it's a point of intervention as urologists and as healthcare providers for us to screen men aggressively, and that's where the role of Prostate Cancer Awareness Month comes in, is making sure that men are screening appropriately.
Is prostate cancer a bigger problem in America than in other countries?
Prostate cancer, yeah, great question. Prostate cancer is a problem in all countries. And in each of those countries, different governmental, institutional processes have affected how people are screened. And so the question of appropriate screening comes up. And in 2012, for example, the United States Preventive Services Task Force recommended against PSA screening in men of all
ages. That's a blood test?
That's a blood test, yeah. PSA stands for prostate-specific antigen, and recommended against PSA screening in men of all ages.
Why?
Well, they believed that it led to over-treatment of non-clinically important prostate cancers. And that was, we look back now and think, that was a major setback in preventative care for men urologically in the United States relative to other countries around the world. It was believed that by checking PSA, prostate-specific antigen, that we were over-diagnosing and over-treating low-grade and low-risk prostate cancers that weren't going to kill people. What we saw, though, in the years following that recommendation, in 2014, for example, we saw people who were diagnosed with prostate cancer present at later stages of the disease. Look at the former President Joe Biden diagnosed with prostate cancer. This is the President of the United States diagnosed with stage 4 prostate cancer, and people all across the political spectrum looking at that as an example of, hey, this is the President of the United States. How does he not have appropriate screening? And so we're still kind of fighting the after effects of that recommendation from the United States Preventive Services Task Force. That subsequently has been rolled back, and now people are recommended to get PSA screened, according to the American Urological Association, between age 50 and 70.
Are insurance companies good with this?
Yeah, insurance companies cover it. It's standard of care to get your PSA screened. That's, again, prostate-specific antigen. It's a simple blood test. You're going to get your labs checked for your primary doctor anyway. It's very easy to add PSA onto that. And every 1 to 2 years between age 50 and 70 is standard screening. And in men who are higher risk for prostate cancer, people with a family history of prostate cancer, people who have black ancestry, people who have germline mutations, people who have had prior prostate biopsies with atypical findings, those guys need to have PSA checked anywhere between 40 and 45 and on. And that discussion of when to start screening is typically best done with a urologist.
Has that number changed? Has the earliest age for checking changed over the last 10, 20 years?
No. Urologists think that, yeah, age 50 is an appropriate age to start checking. Your risk, you know, your de novo risk of getting prostate cancer when you're 35, you're 40, you're out on the street, you don't have a family history of prostate cancer. And if we picked you off the street, your risk of having prostate cancer is probably low relative to men in their 50s, 60s, and 70s.
You know, you, in answering the first question, you talked about, you made a statement that included the phrase non-critically important.
Yeah.
Is any cancer non-critically important?
Yeah, great
clinically
question.
Important, I should say.
Great question, and this is at the crux of why prostate cancer screening has been controversial and how it's been managed by medical societies and primary care providers, you know, in quotes, quote-unquote controversial, is that there are prostate cancers that we are so good at diagnosing, we can diagnose early enough, that they are low risk, and those low-risk cancers, we typically think, will not kill you or will not change to intermediate or higher
ever.
Risk. Well, will not change to intermediate or higher risk cancers for the timescale of like years later in life. And we are not as granular and sophisticated to know which of those low risk cancers will never progress or which will change 5, 10, 15 years from now. And prostate cancer, though, here's the other key. Prostate cancer, when caught early, is highly curable. When it is caught in an advanced presentation, it's outside of the prostate, it is not curable. It's highly treatable, and we can keep people alive for many years with prostate cancer that has advanced and spread, and metastatic prostate cancer patients can live many years, but they're not curable disease. So you have to catch the cat before it's out of the bag.
Now, in the case of former President Biden,
yeah,
he has stage four.
Yeah.
Ordinarily, you think, okay, an organ you're stage four, you take it out. This is well beyond that. So is prostate cancer the major problem here, or is it when it metastasizes throughout the body?
Yeah, I would argue that, yeah, prostate cancer, like other cancers, become an issue for people and can cause mortality, can cause you to die when they spread and cause problems outside of their organ that they originate in. So if prostate cancer just stayed low risk and stayed in your prostate your entire life, that would be a non-clinically important prostate cancer. It is when prostate cancer spreads that people can have organ failure, bone fractures, problems related to metastasis of cancer. That's mostly true for all solid organ tumors. And, yeah, so you want to catch prostate cancer before it becomes clinically significant.
September is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. We're joined today by Dr. David Kosminski, a general urologist with Capital Region Urology, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners. I assume that it takes quite a long time to get from non-clinically important to stage four. And how long did Joe Biden have this without being the president of the United States? They didn't know. What happened?
Good question. In scientific research, we're still trying to parse out how you can prognosticate to determine which prostate cancer spread quickly and which take many, many years to change. There are some sophisticated tools that we're using on the clinical side of things. Like if we see you in our clinic, if you see a urologist in clinic, there are some things that we're employing currently. There are some genomic tests, blood tests, urine tests that help differentiate some risk based on a cancer that's diagnosed. We also have prostate MRI, so MRI imaging that we use to help guide our decision on getting a biopsy as well as help give a prognosis for how advanced a cancer is.
Is the MRI a game changer for you guys?
MRI has been a game changer in the last, for sure, 5+ years. You know, one of the reasons the United States Preventive Services Task Force, you know, 13 years ago said we need to screen PSA less is because everybody got a biopsy and everybody got treatment, even those low-grade, low-risk cancers. But we have become very sophisticated. Just because we diagnose you with a low-risk cancer does not mean you're going to have a surgery to remove your prostate. It doesn't mean you need radiation. It doesn't mean you need hormone therapy or chemotherapy. We actually have a significant amount of patients that we follow that have low-risk cancers, and part of our clinical interaction with them is to follow those low-risk cancers to make sure they're not getting over-treatment. We wouldn't want to do your surgery if the cancer's not going to kill you. If cancer's not going to kill you and it's not going to bother you, you don't want to have surgery until you need to have surgery. And so MRI has helped us be very accurate with our biopsies. It's helped us stage people with radiographic imaging, which is important. And yeah, MRI in the last few years has been a game changer in prostate health, prostate management, prostate cancer management, for sure. It's an integral part of what we do.
We have to take a break here in a minute or two. Dr. David Kosminski joins us from Capital Region Urology. September is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. If you want to give us a call, it's 800-348-2551, or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. What are the primary causes? And the reason I asked whether it's more prevalent or more of a big deal in America was I'm trying to sort of get a picture of what environmental causes are at play here.
Sure. For great question, by the way. For the last few decades, people have spent countless amounts of dollars trying to ascertain what behavioral things and dietary things can increase the risk of prostate cancer, i.e., what element of prostate cancer how much of that risk that we all inherently may have as men, how much of that risk can I alter by changing lifestyle, by exercising more, by eating a low-fat diet, by taking vitamin E? And those things have been looked at. And I think in clinical practice, I would tell you, I don't know that there's enough evidence to say any one diet or lifestyle is better than another when it comes to overall prostate cancer risk. We tend to tell our patients, you need to live a healthy lifestyle so that if and when you get prostate cancer, you can tolerate the treatment for prostate cancer, because it's the people who tolerate treatment, surgery, radiation, et cetera, that are going to have a longer, healthier life and have better survivorship of their cancer anyway. So low-fat diet, don't smoke, work out, go on a run, you know, go swimming, live a healthy lifestyle. That is true for all of our patients in prostate cancer management, even before they're diagnosed. We want you to live that way.
I would say it's true for all the cancers,
right? True. Yeah, absolutely.
Nobody has ever said this on this show. One of the great reasons for changing lifestyle is so you can tolerate the treatment.
Yeah.
Genius.
Yeah.
Dr. David Kosminski, 2 points for you. We take a break, 800-348-2551, and then we'll hit the phones. The email's voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be back. Little T, the late, great Lee Morgan here on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. That's the telephone number. Yeah, it's a medical Monday. September is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Dr. David Kosminski joins us today from Capital Region Urology. Very quickly before we get to the phones, we've talked about the importance of early detection and early treatment. Just run through for our listeners the main areas of treatment that you guys are doing today, the state of the art.
Yeah, absolutely. So prostate cancer, when localized, so if you catch prostate cancer early enough, that's really the key, because the rate of cure for prostate cancer is particularly high in patients when you catch their prostate cancer that's still within the prostate. And treatment is multifaceted. Really, the gold standard treatment for patients who can surgically tolerate removal of the prostate and lymph nodes is robotic radical prostatectomy. So it's a robotic surgery. It's been done robotically as a standard of care for the last probably 20 years nationally and internationally. We do it robotically here.
Is that complete removal or just part?
Removal of the entire whole gland of the prostate. As well as the lymph nodes. So surgical removal is one form of treatment for patients who are not surgically fit, not fit enough for surgery, or they're on a blood thinner, or they're not cleared by their cardiologist because they had a recent MI, or they're on medication that would prevent them from safely getting through surgery. Those patients are candidates for whole gland radiation, and that's typically mediated and done through a radiation oncologist. So either surgery or radiation are the standard of care for localized prostate cancer. There are some newer technologies that are being vetted clinically that are starting to hit the clinical interface, some focal therapies like focal ablative procedures, which are ablative procedures for cancers that are contained within some aspects of the prostate.
So you're walling it off.
You're really kind of zapping small volumes of cancer in order to avoid some of the side effects of whole gland treatment.
So now, when you do whole gland radiation treatment, does that kill any functionality left in the prostate?
Yeah, the prostate gland. By the way, everyone wants to know, what does the prostate gland do? So the prostate
gland.
So the prostate contributes fluid to the semen ejaculate. It's a hormonal gland. It responds to testosterone, and it contributes fluid to semen ejaculate in men. For men who are not at an age or point in their life where they're trying to have kids, the prostate is more of a nuisance as it grows in life and causes urinary symptoms than it is as being helpful. So we can take out the entire prostate and men still have a lot of their genital urinary function. So the prostate gland comes out in its entirety when you get surgery and you treat an entire prostate gland with radiation. And to answer your question, your original question, yes, it kills all of the prostate cancer cells. It kills all of the prostate cells and actually turns the prostate to scar tissue. And you can, for the most part, continue to have urinary function and some degree of sexual function. But part of the issue with both of those treatment forms, surgery and radiation, are you can have a whole host of side effects from either surgery or radiation, including urinary issues, urinary incontinence, sexual dysfunction. And so big time side effects from both treatment modalities that you'd need a urologist to sort of help you get through.
Chemo not really in the picture?
Chemo, immunotherapy, hormone ablation, systemic hormone therapy, so hormone shots, are typically indicated for patients who have either high-risk disease or prostate cancer that has already spread.
Now, what do the hormones do in this case?
Yeah, great question. So prostate cancer is, one way you can think of it is that prostate cancer is a fire in a fire pit. If you see that there's a fire in a fire pit, okay, you have prostate cancer. If you want to increase the fuel to that fire on a grill or in a fire pit, you increase the testosterone to prostate cancer. Testosterone is like gasoline on a flame. Prostate cancer that has spread is, if you're having a fire in a fire pit out in your backyard and you live near a field, that fire is now all over the field. So prostate cancer has spread. But by turning off the fuel to the fire, you stop the fire from spreading. So testosterone is like fuel for prostate cancer. Testosterone and testosterone synthesis is important for how the prostate turns over cells, and certainly is like a fuel for prostate cancer cells too.
We're joined today by Dr. David Kosminski of Capital Region Urology. The number here is 800-348-2551. Just a point, try to stay away from the fire pit and grilling metaphors. It's Food Friday. That's coming up later in the week. Email here from Frank, who's 46 years old, went to the doctor 8 months ago asking to have prostate checked because he felt like he had to urinate more often than normal after drinking fluids, especially in the morning, and felt like he developed some inflammation around the lower gut. When he asked the doctor to be checked, he simply looked at Frank and asked if he is constantly going to the bathroom, to which I replied no, he says. He said that it wasn't necessary at my age and that those tests can give false positives. Does that seem correct? 46 years old.
Yeah, so this is one of the unfortunate outcomes of that recommendation in 2012 that I referenced from the United States Preventive Services Task Force, that as a cultural outcome, as a medical community outcome, a lot of primary providers in particular have gotten rid of digital rectal exams like a prostate exam and have gotten rid of checking a PSA for younger men in their 40s and 50s. Because of that recommendation, we're not going to check PSA in 40s, 50s, 60s from that recommendation. And I think it's a missed opportunity to diagnose men with prostate cancer at a time that it would be important to clinically intervene, at a time that prostate cancer would be curable. I have diagnosed prostate cancer in a 39-year-old before.
And that's the earliest you have seen?
That I have seen. And it's not unheard of that men that are young in their 30s and 40s and 50s may have particularly high risk for prostate cancer, and that's where the risk stratification comes in. if you have a family history of prostate cancer, if you have germline mutations, if you have black ancestry, the American Urological Association wants you to be screened starting at age 40.
Yeah.
And there are particular instances between you and your clinician, you and your urologist in particular, where we check PSAs on younger guys, guys who have urinary issues, guys who have an abnormal rectal exam, and we feel a nodule on their prostate. Those guys, we got to check PSAs in earlier, and it is an opportunity to catch prostate cancer early. The concept that we're not checking PSA because of a risk of overdiagnosis is really sort of missing the boat. We have fairly sophisticated tools that after a PSA is checked, that we don't live in a vacuum. We have sophisticated tools to tell us whether or not someone then needs the next step, which is a biopsy. Just because you have an elevated PSA doesn't mean then, yeah, we're wheeling you back to the operating room to have your prostate removed. There's a lot of steps that happen between the PSA and the clinical decision-making between you and a urologist, and one would hope that together you're making the correct decision. And so I think not screening the PSA is the mistake.
Now, most medical professions, they are not monoliths, and there is a range of opinion on a lot of topics. We've seen this with breast cancer and early screening. Some doctors were on board, some were not, and that age went up and down and up and down. Is everybody on board with your thinking on this?
Well, urologists in particular, urologists as a community, I mean, this is, I wish it was my thinking. I wish I was smart enough to come up with these recommendations. It's the American Urological Association. So urologists as a whole in the United States and internationally, I think would support the statements that I'm saying, and certainly our guidelines support those recommendations. So, that's standard of care. But for people who, for example, for primary care providers who may not feel comfortable checking a PSA, I would implore and often implore my colleagues in primary care, this is when it's okay to refer a patient to see a urologist. If you don't want to be the one to order the PSA, you don't feel comfortable with it, that's where an educated conversation with a specialist comes into place. And I would encourage listeners who are patients who have not had their PSA checked, have not had a rectal exam, want to talk to a urologist, it's okay to bring up with your primary care provider, hey, I want to be seen by a urologist. That's why we're here.
Dr. David Kosminski is here in Studio A to answer your questions, and we'll do that in 1 minute. Just last question here. Yeah. The primary care docs, is it standard for people over 50 to get the PSA test? I mean, I'm like 97, and I don't even recall ever talking about it with my doctor, but I'm sure it's done. Is that a standard thing?
Yeah, it should be standard of care. But, Ray, whether it's you or any of my other friends, family, whatever, I would recommend that everyone is as informed a patient as you can be. Ask your primary doc what labs they're checking and ask them why they're not checking your PSA. Yeah, at age 50 and above, if you live in the United States and you're a male in the United States, yeah, it's my medical opinion you need to have your PSA checked at least once as a screening exam. From there, if your PSA is elevated and you need additional decision-making on how to follow that, if you need a rectal exam, how frequently you need to have the PSA checked, if you need imaging, if you need a biopsy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is all a little bit more sophisticated decision-making that should be at the level of a specialist.
All right, you ready now? This is the tricky part. We're going to take some calls. All right.
Bring it.
Okay, yeah, let's go to Glenmont. Rose, you're on first.
Hello.
Hi, Rose.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Hi, I heard you say earlier, and I might have missed the other part of it, but you said that you should be screened up to age 70. So what happens after age 70?
Rose, great question. Great question. So yeah, let me clarify exactly what I meant / said. The American Urological Association recommends that we check men in age 50 to 70. That is because that is an important recommendation from them, because up to 70, we think we have healthy enough patients that we can intervene and make a huge difference. But outside of what the American Urological Association says, I often screen men much longer than age 70, depending on how healthy they are.
Okay.
So I have a lot of patients, for example, who, you know, maybe already are diagnosed with a couple different cancers, had a recent heart attack on a blood thinner, and maybe at 75, I'm not screening them as aggressively for a prostate cancer that, you know, if we diagnose a low-risk prostate cancer in that patient, that may not have a tremendous difference on the quality or length of their life. But I have plenty of patients who are 78, 79, 80, who are going to live more than 10, 15, 20 years.
How do you know?
Well, just based on their overall health, and there are prostate cancer and prostate cancer risk tools, as well as, whole life expectancy calculators. There's health prognostic indicators where, you know, you can look at someone. It's like when you look outside and you look at the cars in the parking lot and you see a brand new car. You know, that car is going to have the potential to put more mileage on it than the car right next to it where one of the wheels may be falling off. Yeah. You know just by looking at someone's health information that they're important to screen. So, Rose, to answer your question, I have patients that are 78 or 80 that I'm still mm-hmm. doing rectal exams and checking their PSA, and I have done prostatectomies on patients that are that age. So just because the American Urological Association gives a recommendation doesn't mean we need to dogmatically follow it. What I think is important for patients is to speak to their provider and share decision-making based on their particular health and their particular risk factors.
Rose, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. David Kosminski joins us from Capital Region Urology. Let's head down to Woodstock. It's Karen's turn. Karen, you're on.
Hi. I don't know. Can you hear me?
We sure can, Karen.
Oh, great. Okay, so I have 1, 2, 3 questions. Number one, are you seeing it in younger men now? Number two, environmental factors, anything with, pest control, Roundup, those kind of things that you put in your lawn. And number three, do veterans have any more of a risk than other ones?
Yeah,
people
great.
Who have not been in these services.
Good questions all around. Let's hit all three. So for the first one, I think we see prostate cancer in younger men when we screen more aggressively in those younger men. So for a period of time, I think for a period of time after the United States Preventive Services Task Force came out in 2012, there were a few years where we saw people diagnosed later with prostate cancer and at later stages, so with more advanced disease. So when we are diagnosing men, seems to be a direct correlate to how aggressively we're screening them at younger ages. So I don't know that there's like a wave of younger men being diagnosed with cancer. Obviously, cancer is a pandemic across the board with a lot of different organs. But I think the more aggressively we screen people, the more appropriately we screen people, we are more apt to find prostate cancer in younger men. Remind me, what was question number two, Karen?
Environmental factors.
Oh, yeah.
Which we covered at the beginning of the show.
But environmental factors. Yeah, Karen. So, general environmental factors. Yeah, I typically tell my patients, so behavioral environmental factors. So if you smoke, you're at increased risk of cancer and a lot of different types of cancer. There's some evidence that some organophosphates, some nitrates, some benzenes, if you're exposed to inorganic pollutants, you grew up on a farm spraying fertilizer, you worked in a factory and you were exposed to a bunch of benzene aromatic compounds, you can have increased risk of some cancers. That may be true for prostate cancer, and for sure I have had patients exposed to those chemicals that maybe have higher risk of prostate cancer. We do not screen differently in that population. We don't have official recommendation to do that, but yeah, for sure if you know a man who's been exposed to those type of pollutants long-term, maybe that gentleman is at higher risk than, your average Joe on the street. For your third question, in veterans do sort of across the board, especially, for example, Vietnam veterans who had Agent Orange exposure have higher risk to some solid organ malignancies like prostate cancer than, again, Joe Blow, who was not in Vietnam or did not have Agent Orange exposure. That's the best documented example of cancer risk, increased cancer risk in veterans. Outside of that, I don't have concrete examples, but those are good questions about cancer risk, yeah.
Karen, thanks for the call. Dr. David Kosminski joins us today. 800-348-2551 is our number. We'll take a break here in a moment, then we'll go back to the phones. This email from Elias. Elias says, I'll undergo single-port laparoscopic prostatectomy. What is the soonest reasonable time span that I could have the Foley catheter removed, which we have not discussed in this program? So you better tell us what it is.
Yeah. So great question. This is a big bugaboo about prostate surgery and prostate cancer surgery. The real answer is it's probably surgeon specific. So we do robotic prostatectomy, for example, and I don't do single port robotic prostatectomy. That's a different type of robotic prostatectomy. We do multi-port, which is still the standard of care. So a few small incisions on the abdomen, and surgery takes anywhere from 2 to 4 hours. People spend about one night in the hospital. They usually go home the next day on Tylenol and Motrin after removal of the prostate. But the biggest bugaboo is not post-operative pain or post-operative complication. For the most part, it's a minimally invasive surgery. It's that having a Foley catheter, which is an indwelling urethral catheter, long-term after the procedure in order for you to heal. And for the most part, I think nationally, that's anywhere from 7 days to 14 days. So I tell people 1 to 2 weeks, you'd have a catheter after prostatectomy, and that is very annoying for guys.
Are you in the hospital for that whole time?
No, you're just in the hospital usually about one night. You go home post-op day one.
So you're walking around with a catheter.
You go home with a catheter, and we do a really good job educating patients on how to manage the catheter. It usually goes to a small bag that goes strapped around your leg, and you can wear pants over that. So you can ride in a car, go to the store, and you have a catheter in. And that's annoying for guys who don't typically have catheters because it's pulling and tugging, and that's uncomfortable. And so one question that people want to know in the perioperative counseling is, how long do I have to have this in? When can I get it out? And for sure, the number one reason that people call clinic after a prostatectomy or come in and kind of bang the door down trying to get into clinic is, get the catheter out of this thing is annoying. And so it is annoying, and it's an important question for quality improvement when it comes to the surgery itself. But there's a reason that we have a catheter in that long, and that is because when we remove the prostate, you have to reconnect the bladder to the urethra. The prostate sits between the bladder and the urethra, and so you have to reconnect the bladder to the urethra, and that takes time to heal.
Interesting.
So you don't want to remove the catheter too soon.
But isn't that an infection risk, walking around in your own home?
It is.
I mean, some people live like slobs.
Yeah. Don't live like a slob. Yeah, it is. It can be an infectious risk. And in particular, data has shown that people who have a catheter in 2, 3, 4 weeks long term, that's the bigger infectious risk. We think the minimal risk of infection with having a catheter in for 7 to 10 days is outweighed by the effectiveness in healing after a surgery. And that's some of the risk that we are willing to kind of work with for patients to get them through surgery.
Dr. David Kosminski joins us. It's a Medical Monday. We'll get back to the phones in a moment. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be back. Next Stage, the New World Jazz Composers Quintet, right? That's five. Quintet is called Sextet? Octet. Oh, well, that's a lot of them. 800-348-2551 is our number. Medical Monday. And we're joined by Dr. David Kosminski. September is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Let's go to Schenectady, and it's Nick's turn. Nick, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, Nick.
Okay. At night when I urinate, late at night, and I have a pretty steady urination, then when I wash my hands, which I always do after a bathroom, I have to immediately urinate again after I use the water on my hands. I can't leave the bathroom without doing it again. And I heard with that Byron thing, he had some kind of split urination that caused some of his trouble. Is there anything troubling about that I have to urinate again after I wash my hands after I do it the first time?
So, Nick, great question for a urologist. Great question for a urologist. It's a straightforward question, and I got to tell you, it's a complex answer. For the most part, when I hear those symptoms in a male patient, needing to double urinate at night, frequency of urination, feeling of incomplete emptying, maybe a weaker stream at night. By the way, those are common urinary symptoms in men of a certain age. But my initial concern as a urologist is you're probably not completely emptying your bladder. I have a lot of patients that come in and say, oh, yeah, you know, I'm totally emptying. And then we'll use an ultrasound machine and scan your bladder for a volumetric scan after you urinate in clinic. And then we can sort of objectively show you're probably not completely emptying your bladder. And in a male patient who's referred to a urologist in this setting,
is that bad for you?
It depends, Nick. Again, good question. It depends on the degree at which you're not emptying. So it's probably normal for some guys to have some obstructive urinary symptoms at night. But if you're not emptying your bladder, that can eventually be bad for your kidneys and your kidney function.
I feel fine after I do the second one. I don't have any pain at all.
Well, you probably need an evaluation by a urologist. You may not be as emptying as well as you think. You probably need the full evaluation, a prostate exam, potentially a PSA, making sure you empty your bladder with a bladder scan. And because not
I
emptying
plan
your bladder.
On doing that. Yeah, well, I plan on doing a scan.
Oh, absolutely do. Not emptying your bladder puts you at risk for kidney failure, bladder stones, recurrent urinary tract infections. And so you may not be having those issues now, knock on wood, but your question of, is this a harbinger of something worse? The answer is, yeah, it can be. And that's typically when we'd recommend that you get seen by a urologist.
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. This business of washing the hands, is that psychological or, you know, you saw the old campground trick where somebody's asleep, they put their hand in warm water and they have to pee.
Yeah.
Is this the washing of the hands has nothing to do with this in this case, right?
Well, at first I thought you were asking, washing your hands is important. Yeah, I tell my kids to wash their hands.
Congratulations to Nick for doing that. Good job.
Yeah, good job, Nick. That's good. Your question is it psychological or is it real? And I would answer and say that both are true. The bladder is a highly social organ. Your bladder is a trained organ. You were not continent when you were born, and you somehow trained your bladder to hold your bladder, and you go pee when you need to go pee. So just because it's psychological does not mean it's not real.
Okay.
So people who wash their hands in cold or warm water may have a reflex to have bladder squeeze and feel like they have to go pee. That's fairly common. There's a lot of different environmental factors that contribute to people feeling frequency, urgency, need to go pee. And so, yeah, that's normal. That happens. And it's good that you wash your hands, Nick, and good that you go back to the bathroom.
And you go back to bed. Good for you. So this is all, it's all good. Steven in Stone Ridge writes, I'm 57. My brother died last year from small cell prostate cancer at age 62. My father died from pancreatic cancer. My mother has a history of breast cancer. Given my higher risk of developing prostate cancer, what kind of screening would the doctor recommend for someone with my family history?
Yeah, it's a great question. First off, I'm sorry for the losses in your family. I'm sorry about your brother. That your brother's type of prostate cancer is a unique type of prostate cancer, that small cell carcinoma. That's not actually the typical prostatic adenocarcinoma that we screen for with PSA. But I would, in your situation, do a couple things. If I were in your shoes, A, you may have a genetic syndrome in your family. It sounds like you have a lot of cancer in your family. Genetic syndrome that predisposes you to cancer. And so look into getting checked for that with genomic studies, genetic tests. There are geneticists that can screen you to see if you have genetic risk for cancer. And you may have already started that. B, in the urology office, if you were my patient, we'd be checking a PSA, a prostate-specific antigen, that lab value. We'd be doing a digital rectal exam. And we'd be considering heavily getting a prostate MRI, even as a screening tool, to look for radiographic lesions in your prostate that could be monitored versus biopsied to screen you for prostate cancer. So PSA, a rectal exam, and prostate MRI, I think, 10 out of 10 urologists would say that's some basic screening that you need to be doing. And then I would, again, support the American Urological Association guidelines that state that he should probably have PSA screening every 1 to 2 years. You've got a family history of cancer, so starting really at age 40 or 45, you should be getting your PSA checked.
We're joined by Dr. David Kosminski today. The number is 800-348-2551. Fred writes in, I'm 77 years old, in excellent health, no symptoms or problems. Should I be getting a digital exam or PSA at my annual physical? 77.
Yeah, if you're in excellent health, I think a digital rectal exam at the very least is a reasonable idea. The American Urological Association, as the prior caller pointed out, stops their recommendation after 70. But if you're in excellent health, then that's between you and your provider. There's what's called in the literature shared decision making, which is, as a provider, we try to give you all of the tools to screen early and live a healthy life. And then you can make a decision on if you want to have a PSA checked. And I think, if I were seeing you in clinic, it's for me a no-brainer to check a PSA. Because if that comes back low and you're in excellent health, great. Then we can look at each other and say, we don't need to do this for a couple years. Everything checked out, gives you peace of mind. If it comes back high, just because it comes back high doesn't mean you're, sort of projected down a path that's going to be traumatic or involve a lot of treatment or something. It just means that we need to have additional intelligent conversations about what to do. And I think if somebody's in excellent health at 77, I have plenty of patients that we screen their PSA.
All right. One more email, and then we'll go back to the phones with Dr. David Kosminski. Rich writes in, my prostate was removed 2 years ago after cancer diagnosis and Gleason score of 9. I have a PSA test every few months. Recently, it ticked up from undetectable to 0.06. My doctor feels the best approach is to continue to monitor and not resort to radiation unless it increases to 0.2. Am I taking the right approach? I'm a white male, age 76, and that's from Rich.
Yeah, Rich, great question. Another example of a great question with a complex answer that if you sat in clinic with me, it may be a 45-minute visit because it's a sophisticated answer. On the whole, in your question prompt, I would say, yeah, that is an appropriate treatment. You've already had primary treatment for high-risk prostate cancer. High-risk meaning even after treatment, you may have a biochemical recurrence of PSA. So your PSA went from being undetectable to being 0.06. That's what we would characterize as biochemical recurrence of PSA after treatment. And the way to understand if you need additional treatment would initially be what's called a PSMA PET scan. A PSMA PET scan has come out in the last few years as being a highly specific and sensitive PET scan for patients in your shoes. If you can get the PSMA PET scan done, that would be helpful. Short of that, we typically tell people until your PSA goes up to 0.2, we wouldn't recommend radiation or hormone therapy because those treatments both cause symptoms and side effects. And we wouldn't want to treat you unless we thought that we needed to. So just because your PSA is 0.06 does not mean that you're symptomatic from recurrence of prostate cancer.
But wait, the prostate was removed.
Yeah. So good question. Yeah, just because the prostate's removed, sometimes when PSA recurs after the prostate comes out, it means that there may have been a cancer cell in a lymph node or a cancer cell in tissue that was not removed. And that cancer cell over time can emit PSA and demonstrate some recurrence. Sometimes after people have their prostate removed, you can have benign PSA recurrence, which is a prostate cell that was not removed that is, you know, lodged somewhere and growing somewhere, can emit PSA, and that's benign recurrence of PSA. So your urologist sounds like they're using some discretion to determine if and when you need to act on recurrence of PSA. Mm-hmm. And it's not unreasonable to first see if the PSA goes up every few months over time. But I would recommend for a patient in this situation to consider a PSMA PET scan and to consider a consultation with medical oncology as well.
We're joined by Dr. David Kosminski of Capital Region Urology. Our number is 800-348-2551. Let's go back to the phones to New Paltz and Elizabeth. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi. My friend is scheduled to start a procedure with CyberKnife in Manhattan because I didn't know that you existed in Albany. And by the way, all procedures, including CyberKnife, involves stopping blood thinners. So it doesn't matter. You still have to stop blood thinners.
Thank you.
I want to know, because it's very inconvenient for him, he's got to take a bus and then a train. Is there any way that we can contact you in a very timely manner so we could switch everything to you in Albany?
Elizabeth, I appreciate that. They have a website. There is a link on our website, but we can't do that kind of business here on this program. But I do wish you the best. Go ahead, Doc.
I will just say, Ray, I just want to jump in. Elizabeth, if you're still listening, just call our clinic. I will just say, in general, for people who are set to undergo CyberKnife, so what is CyberKnife? People will have read that online and seen it. CyberKnife is a type of stereotactic body radiation, what's called SBRT, that is the quote-unquote more advanced type of radiation for prostate cancer. For sure, I know CyberKnife is offered down in New York City for people locally here in the Capital District. I have a lot of patients that go down to kind of get CyberKnife as being the next tool in radiation oncology. For the most part, Elizabeth, I do refer patients with these type of questions to radiation oncology. So your friend needs to talk to his radiation oncologist locally to see if there are just as effective radiation techniques locally here. We do obviously offer that locally as well. And I have to tell you, a vast majority of my patients that do not get CyberKnife radiation, that get standard external beam radiation locally with radiation oncology partners here, do phenomenally well and have very high cure rates. So if it's a huge inconvenience to your friend, consider not taking the bus and train and staying local in the Capital District.
You know, CyberKnife, just briefly here, is that proton beam? What are we talking about?
It's not proton beam. It's, and we're wading a little bit into areas that I'm
It's been a while since we've had a radiation oncologist on the show.
And we're going to need to have one to answer that question appropriately.
Okay,
but
enough.
CyberKnife is a sort of, quote, it's the newest kind of age of whole gland radiation And it basically delivers highly precise, high doses of radiation directly to the cancerous tissue while attempting to, here's the key with all radiation, to minimize the damage to other local structures.
That's right.
So CyberKnife is billed as being kind of less damage to other pelvic structures, which will ultimately lead people to have less side effects. And to get into the weeds on that, I would encourage all patients to talk to a radiation oncologist.
All right, and we'll have one on the show soon, I hope. And let's
I'll come too. I'll join them.
Okay, well, we'll see if Courtney invites you.
Okay.
Bill in Queensbury. Bill, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I had external beam radiation in 2005, you know, 21 years ago. And in 21, there's a biochemical recurrence.
Yeah.
And so that's 4 years ago. When should I be able to have cryotherapy in terms of how high the PSA can go at this point?
Yeah. So, Bill, good question. Technically complex question to answer in just a minute here, but... A couple things. One, we would need to know the total value of your PSA and how quickly your PSA is rising after radiation therapy. Now, it's been 20 years. First off, phenomenal that you made 20 years without biochemical recurrence. Some patients recur sooner. And so anyway, now you're dealing with potential for biochemical recurrence. It would depend a little bit on your PSA, your total PSA, your PSA velocity, and on the radiographic findings from a PET scan. So a PSMA PET scan would tell us where cancer has recurred. If we assume, Bill, that cancer has recurred, you know, where the prostate is and was, then you may be a candidate for some salvage cryotherapy procedures, which is what you're talking about. The problem with those procedures, they may have some rate of cure, of recurrence in that area. But those procedures, the more ablative procedures that you do to the prostate after radiation, you have a much higher risk of urethral stricture and urinary incontinence. I have had patients that have had multiple kind of bouts of ablative procedures, cryotherapy, radiation, et cetera, to the prostate that are now, unfortunately, permanently incontinent. We do have procedures that we can help them fix that, but then you're buying more surgeries than you would have needed before. And so cryotherapy may or may not be the best option for you, depending on your PSA, what a PSMA PET scan shows, and counseling from your urologist. I don't want to dissuade you from getting something that you think you need, but outside of cryotherapy, there are other options that are systemic therapies like hormone therapy, where you would not theoretically have higher risk of incontinence.
All right, Bill, we're going to have to leave it there. You know, Dr. Kosminski, that was pretty fast. We're done.
Oh, my goodness.
One quick email here from Rob. What's the difference between TURP procedure and simple prostatectomy?
Yeah, great question.
20 seconds.
Yeah, 20 seconds. Great question. TURP is an endoscopic procedure through the urethra. You have a catheter for a day or two after a TURP procedure, and it's typically done for moderate-sized prostates. A simple prostatectomy is a robotic surgery with a few incisions. You actually do have to have incisions, and it's typically saved for patients with much larger prostates.
You know, we're done. Count Basie's
it's plan. Been a pleasure.
You
Ray.
Were great, man. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for your help.
Support comes from Prestwick Chase, offering maintenance-free housing options for 55-plus active adults with one- and two-bedroom apartments and cottages in historic Saratoga Springs. 518-584-7766 to schedule tours. Thanks again to Dr. David Kosminski of Capital Region Urology for being here today. Huge apology to all of those left on the line today. Well, we do the topic fairly often, and we will do it again soon. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Bob Rathman screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Oh, I love it. Today, it's urology and prostates and whatnot. Tomorrow, it's transmissions and brakes and Wankel rotary engines. Yes, it's cars with Gordon Fricke tomorrow at 2. We'll see you then.